Hail, hail. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Celtic Lifetime 11 podcast, brought to you by CelticUnderground.net. Welcome back for another show. This week I am joined by another guest who reached out via Twitter, Mr. Tony Moran, who is very eloquent and very wise when discussing Celtic. They are definitely words that I would apply to anyone who says lots of things I agree with. Listeners of the show, thank people who are enjoying it. Thanks for letting us know. Just try to fill your head while you're cycling or staring at a spreadsheet or going to work or whatever. Those who don't like the show, I've got some wonderful news for you. You are not Winston Smith. You are not trapped in room 101. The voice in your head, me right now, you can make it stop. You can just press the stop button on your MP3 player or your iPhone or whatever it is. You don't need to listen to this. I am not Big Brother. Emphatically, I don't have any younger siblings, so I have never been a big brother. I am at best a little brother, and that being the case, I have no power to punish you furthermore. So please stop listening if it's really going to bother you. Seriously, turn it off. Go away. Knowing me, Tony Murray, knowing you, Tony Moran, welcome to the show, Tony.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
I'm assuming you're named after St. Anthony of Padua, like myself.
I don't know, but I would. It sounds good, so let's go with that. Yeah.
Actually, it's the only pilgrimage I've ever been on. I was on holiday in Bologna a couple of years ago, and that was close enough to Padua to get a train. You know, like a day trip. Mm-hmm. So I popped up to the Basilica of St. Anthony and wandered about there and tried to be profound. And you know, it was nice. I've said it in other podcasts. If you're going to be a beggar and you want to get money out of me, park outside a Catholic basilica after I've had a moment of inspiration, an epiphany.
That's when you're at your best.
Oh, that's when I'm at my weakest. I will throw money at you when I'm thinking someone's watching. You know. Anyway, okay. Quickly away from the Catholicism. It'll alienate some of our lefty listeners. Right, so Tony, you've done time in Dundee, haven't you, in Edinburgh and everywhere else?
Well, done time, no, I've never lived up there. My dad's from Dundee, so
all right, okay.
I've got quite a lot of family up in Dundee, so I'm up and down there occasionally, but most of my time has been spent either Livingston or Edinburgh.
Okay, so Central Belt.
Yes, my mum's from Glasgow, dad's from Dundee, and we were kind of somewhere, I guess, in the middle, Livingston, West Lothian.
Yep, have I ever been to Livingston? I think I've played away games there for numerous football teams. Definitely lost games. I've definitely lost football matches in Livingston.
Yeah, I'm surprised you don't remember it better. It's usually everyone loves it.
Oh, yeah. Well, why would I not go back? You know, it's the Bratislava of central Scotland. A place people visit briefly, then never go back.
Yeah, if you want to see a lot of roundabouts, make sure you come out because there's plenty of them. We always hear.
All right, okay. I'll look into that. I'm not a driver, so that's why I wouldn't have noticed. Right, so you're here to give us your Lifetime 11. Starts off, as usual, you're going to give me your formation. What is it?
So I'm going to go 4-3-1-2.
I'm digging that. That might be the future of modern Celtic.
I don't know. It's never one that I've seen Celtic really play, but the guys that I'm selecting just seem to fit into that formation quite well. So that's what I've ended up with.
I think this might be, because we finished the game the other night. I mean, I've no idea when this podcast will go out, mm-hmm. but the other night, we, you know, this was the shape for the last moments.
Yeah, I think a jetty coming in probably maybe means that we're going to go to a two up front as well. And I'd like to see that, because I think the Strachan Hartson argument the other night about is he a 10 or a 9, he's a 9.5 if anyone, you know, if we can do that. I think he's good in both roles, but I think with someone up there, I think when Griffiths was playing with him towards the end of last season, it brought out the best in him, just allows him to get turned on the back four, drop off and get turned. I think that's his best.
Yeah, he has something else. Just quick, briefly talking about the modern game. I love the fact that I saw someone yesterday on Twitter complaining about a Yeti not being ready. Like, it's been 20 minutes.
He was on holiday in Sardinia, was he not, for like 2 weeks before he signed? So
yeah, he's probably full of calamari or whatever they eat. Right, okay, so we've got our formation. We'll start, as usual, with the goalkeeper. Who's your man in sticks?
So, no major surprises. An honourable shout-out to Fraser Forster, but I need to go with Boritz. I think Boritz, especially his kind of first 2 or 3 years at Celtic, was just best goalkeeper I've seen by a long way. And he was probably, I mean, at the time of Euro 2008, I was, I think Euro 2008 was in Germany, and I was in Poland at the time. And we were watching the game over there. And I remember my wife, who's Polish, telling me after the Germany game that the press basically described it as Boritz versus Germany. Because this was Poland pre-Lewandowski and that, obviously. And he was probably the best goalkeeper in that tournament.
Yeah.
And as good as Forster has been at Celtic, I don't know if at any point he would have been able to make a claim like that. Even if he was England's number one, you know, I don't know if he was quite at that level. Boritz just, he just had everything for me.
I think you're right about that. And that's one of the interesting things, because it wasn't like, you know, sometimes you have a, like Gareth Bale at Wales right now. If he wasn't there, there wouldn't be another guy that was nearly as good as him. Do you know what I mean? There's no alternative to Bale. That Polish team, there was like Fabianski, a young Krzyzewski, there was someone else. Do you know what I mean?
Jerzy Dudek.
Yeah, Dudek was around. There was this sort of genuinely A, B list clutch of good Polish goalkeepers. So it wasn't like Boric was just one of them. He was the guy that, when he was fit and going, got picked ahead of them all.
That's right. And I think at that time, Legia Warsaw had a pretty well thought of goalkeeping coach.
Yeah.
You know, the Stevie Woods of Poland, possibly. And a lot of those guys, I think Fabianski and Boritz, and I think maybe, I can't remember if the guy who was at Man United, Kuszak, he was Polish.
Yeah.
I can't remember if he came through, but there was definitely a clutch of them that came through in Poland at that time. And you're right, I think Boritz was the best of the bunch. You know, even Dudek won the Champions League with Liverpool, obviously. But I would rate Boritz as a better goalkeeper than him. And at that tournament, he was just fantastic. I think Germany beat them 2-0, but it should have been about 10 if it wasn't for Boritz. And the other one for me was like the Man United game when we beat them, Nakamura's free kick at Parkhead, and when he made the save from Saha's penalty. It was just the presence that he had in goal. I remember Saha lining that penalty up, and I had my scarf up at my mouth, and I was just muttering under it like, please Arthur, please Arthur. And then he pulled it off, you know, and it was just classic Boritz.
It was an unbelievable save. And I just to flip it on its side, I always kind of felt sorry for Saha. Because Saha had started at Man United. Not that I've got any particular allegiance for Man United, but Saha had started quite well at United. And he never came back from that.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And he also, like, during the game, do you remember the one he went through and he thought he was offside and he kind of half stopped and then he tried to lob Boritz and Boritz kind of clawed it away. But I think the atmosphere of the whole thing got to Saha and maybe even a little bit of Boritz's presence and goal. But you're right, I think Saha was kind of on a slippery slope after that at Man United.
But yeah, all because of nasty Artur Boric putting in one of the great saves.
But he was also, he just had that, he was Schmeichel-like as well. I remember when he made his debut at Leicester. I'm pretty sure it was a friendly game the first time I saw him. Because David Marshall, remember, had been playing against Armita Bratislava. Yeah. And I think the Leicester friendly was directly after that. And Boric came in and he just had that presence. As soon as you saw him, his physicality, his size, his agility. And then he saved a penalty in that game, I think, as well. And you were just looking at him thinking, up until that point, the Celtic goalkeepers had never inspired me. And when you saw Boritz in goal and just the way he moved and everything, you thought, wow, we've got something here.
Yeah, when he first came, he had the shaved head and he was really lean, because I think he did get a little bit chunkier later on.
Yeah.
But that first 18 months, he was untouchable as a Celtic goalkeeper.
If he had a better mentality, he really should have been the goalkeeper for a Man United or something like that. You know, because you're right, he let himself go a wee bit. And if he'd just been a bit more professional and the rest of it, he would have been, you know, a goalkeeper for Bayern or Man United or something like that, I think.
But credit where it's due. August 2020, he's out there last night putting out Linfield. So he's still getting it up the Huns as an older man.
Is that right? I missed that. That's good.
Yeah, he was at Legia Warsaw. It must have been either his debut or close or return debut. Right. But yeah, he's still in the Champions League or at least the Europa League or something like that. But he's still involved and still annoying Huns from Belfast.
Good for him. He's probably in among the Legia ultras after the game as well.
Or a bunch of cardboard cutouts of them. Excellent. Right. So we're getting into our back four. Left to right or right to left?
I'll go left to right and I'll start
that,
with this.
That would always be my choice.
Yeah.
All my guests, I think so far, have gone right to left and it irks me every time. So thank you for going left to right. That would be my instinct.
It's the only sensible option.
It must be a Tony thing. It must be an Anthony.
Exactly. So again, I'll give a mention to Tommy Boyd, who was pretty close, but I have to go with Tierney. I think Tierney at the European level, when he was playing with us, you could see in those games in the Champions League and Europa League and that he just physically, he was something special. He had pace, he was strong, especially as he got a bit older and filled out. He was strong enough, brilliant in the tackle, great going forward, very hard to beat defensively. I can't really remember any winger giving him a hard time. And when you think that in the Champions League, he was head-to-head against Raheem Sterling at Man City. And Sterling is one of the elite wingers in Europe, you'd have to say. But Tierney gave him as good as he got. You know, like he was driving him back at times. He even kind of scored that deflected goal at Parkhead. And Sterling was the guy he deflected it off of. And he came up against Mbappe as well for PSG. And even though PSG gave us a doing, Tierney, I thought, was one of the guys that came through that pretty well. Yeah. And he was against, you know, an absolutely flying Mbappe. So Tierney, for me, he has to be, even though he left, maybe not in the greatest of circumstances, I don't really hold anything against him for it. But he was for me, the obvious choice for left back.
Yeah, not going to get a disagreement from me. Thinking about the Champions League, the assist away at Anderlecht was a great moment.
Yep.
We are, you know, not that I don't think Anderlecht, you know, they are our sort of level of club that we should be competing with. So it's that rare moment where we go in an away game in a Champions League and genuinely give a team a doing. And it's all part of that. I think the first goal was that the first goal?
I think that was the first one, because Ncham plays a beautiful ball. And Ncham had a funny game that night. The first 20 minutes, he gave the ball away every time he got it. But then he played a beautiful ball kind of in between the centre-half and the full-back for Tierney to run on. And you're right, he just put it across goal. And I think it was Griffiths that stuck it in.
That was it. Yeah, because the other two goals were to the goal on the right, and that was on the goal on the left, And that just that energy and the execution of the perfect, you know, ball across the thing, just to give really a tap in for the striker.
And the other thing that I was thinking about when I was thinking about Tommy Boyd, and I love Tom Boyd because when he first came, you know, back in the early 90s, that's kind of my earliest memories of Celtic. When we played Cologne and Borussia Dortmund in the UEFA Cup, Tom Boyd was great in those games. You know, he was bombing up the wing. He was really good. And it was a little bit unfair on Boyd because he got moved to centre-half later on in his career, which probably wasn't his best position. But I always just felt Boyd had a little mistake in him here or there. And Tierney never really done that. Tierney was, I can't almost ever think of Tierney making a big mistake that gave away goals.
Yeah, there was no fingers getting pointed at Tierney, really, during his Celtic career. He just came in and was just brilliant from the get-go. Yeah.
And it's scary when you think that he's... Like, I've read him just in the last day or two in the papers saying that he was fourth choice in Celtic, like under 20s, I think it was, until Dyla spotted him. And then the next thing you knew, he was basically fast-tracked in at the first team. But you wonder how can a guy like Tierney be sitting fourth choice and Andy Robertson was let go? And, you know, who were the other three left-backs that we had?
I like that fact that, you know how sometimes something amazing happens in a youth match and it goes viral? I don't know if it's a retrospective viral thing, but there's that video where Tierney scores. I think it's away at Capello from his own half, you know, literally just outside the box, and he guns it. And usually, you know, some kid that does... I remember Rocco Quinn scoring a similar wonder goal. And what the hell ever happened to Rocco Quinn? So the fact that Tierney, you know, did it at that youth level, got the chance to move up and took it, is something that, I mean, you can only admire the guy. He's an absolute legend and definitely would be in my lifetime 11, no doubt about it.
Yep.
Right, who's next to him? First centre-half.
So the first centre-half, the left of the centre-halves, I'll go with Van Dijk. And it's... I know everyone goes with Van Dijk, so it's not a lot more to say about him. I was actually reasonably close to leaving him out, and the reason I say it is because, you know, obviously Van Dijk at Liverpool now is probably the best centre-half in the world. And when he was at Celtic, he was still a brilliant centre-half. He wasn't quite at that level. You could see he had the potential, especially the attributes he had physically, technically. He had everything to go at that level. But he did make a couple of mistakes in Europe. I remember the away game against Malmo. I thought he was pretty poor in that game. That was one of the last games he played for us. And they scored for a couple of set-piece corners. I think it was corners that came in right into the heart of the box. And he was kind of left wanting once or twice. And over and into Milan, he got a daft red card when we were still in that tie. So there was a couple of things that I held against him a little bit, but overall, he was just quality, especially domestically at that time. You know, he was strolling those games. And the beauty of it is, since he's went to Southampton and Liverpool, he's kind of continued that way, where he looks as if he's not even really trying, and it's still men against boys. He was just quality all round.
Yeah, definitely. Van Dijk was a phenomenal player. I'd say one of the shame things about, you know, the Euros being postponed this summer, because, you know, he really is at the peak of his powers. And I think a couple of Dutch players are, you know, this might have been a year where the Dutch, you know, might have turned up at a tournament and done well. You know, maybe in a year's time that won't be the case. Maybe they'll win it next year, I don't know. But it'd be interesting to see if you could take it into the international scene.
Yeah, well, they've definitely came back a lot stronger. I mean, a few years ago it looked as though they'd really kind of fell away. But you're right, guys like the other guy, De Ligt, centre-half, who's the Ajax guy, who's now at Juventus, and De Jong from Barca. And they've definitely got a good team at the moment. But Van Dijk is, I have to say, I'm surprised even a little bit how well he's done since he went to Liverpool, because he's clearly, I think, the best centre-half in the world, you know. And even though he had that potential at Celtic, if someone had said that he would be head and shoulders almost above guys like Sergio Ramos and Boateng at Bayern and all those guys, Bonucci and all that, you would have maybe, even the Celtic fans, you would have maybe doubted, well, could he be that good? But he is. He's really that good, and he's should be the first name on the team sheet for Liverpool, really.
Yeah. Yep. No disagreement for me. And who's going to partner him as a centre-half?
It has to be, for me, Bobo Baldi. And yes. I'm always amazed.
Sorry. Yes. His first appearance in the show. And you're right. Yes. I'm with you. I've been waiting to talk about this guy for weeks. Carry on. Sorry.
I'm amazed that this is the first time he's been in the show, to be honest. And I think this is how I ended up getting on this show, because I replied to someone on Twitter saying, where's Bobo Baldi? And I had a few people, you know, replying to me and saying, oh, Bobo this. I think people have forgot, actually, just how good Bobo Baldi was. Now, he wasn't a technical player, right? When you look at Van Dijk, he had everything. Baldi didn't have everything, but what he did have was just being a monster at the back. If you needed a guy to defend going to Ibrox, you know, you're going to Ibrox tomorrow and they're throwing in any centre forward that they like, he was the guy to put the shirt on, because he was a monster at the back. I never once saw him lose a physical battle, and you knew going into any game that he was going to bully the opposition centre forward and quite often put them off their game because they were intimidated by him. And when you think of the run that we had to Seville in 2002-2003, he got player of the year that year from the fans. And, you know, Larsson was at his peak at that point. And whether he should have got it over Larsson's debatable, but the fact that he got it and the performances he put in places like Celta Vigo and down at Anfield, when he was a rock, especially the Celta Vigo game, like Celtic were under the caution that game for a long time away from home. And he was right in the middle of that back three, and he just held everything together. There was not a single ball that he couldn't win. And they were a good side. They had Benny McCarthy. They had Gustavo Lopez kind of playing in that wide centre-wide position. And Bobo, for me, held it together. And I don't think that we would have probably made it to Seville without Bobo. Larsson as well, obviously. But Bobo was critical.
Absolutely. I mean, we've got to one European final and one European quarterfinal in my lifetime. And Bobo was the guy in both teams. Do you know what I mean? That's not a coincidence. Yep. He was a giant. He was hard. He was occasionally nasty. He got a couple of daft red cards. But ultimately, as a defender, just intimidation and just scale and just an absolute mountain of a Celtic player.
And he was quite fast as well for the size of him. You know, he wasn't I don't think he was as fast as Van Dijk, but he wasn't slow by any measure, Baldi. You know, you very rarely seen him getting outrun by strikers or anything. The two things that probably Celtic fans maybe hold against him a little bit was the red card over in Seville and the penalty in Lyon when he chucked his hand up and... you know, both of those, you know, you look at them and you wish you hadn't done it. And that's maybe what people hold against him. But his performances in other games that got you into those positions to yeah. be able to even be in Seville, or to be able to be, you know, fighting with Leon for that kind of qualifying place in the final game, he was a huge part of it. And for me, he has to be in the team. I would give an honourable mention to quite a few centre-halves. I thought Matt Reaper was key to us stopping 10 in a row.
I genuinely think if I was doing this, I've not done it. I probably never will do it. My two would be Reaper and Baldy.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just being contrary, leaving Van Dijk out, mm-hmm. but just imagine a centre half two of Reaper and Baldy. You're just not getting through that.
No, I thought Reaper was really good, and he got some weird injury with his toe that kind of ended his career with us. But I don't think if he hadn't came in 97 for that 10 in a row season to stop Rangers, I don't think we would have stopped him, because we would, guys like Stubbs and Anoni weren't bad players, but he made them better. You know, Stubbs, yeah. all of a sudden when Reaper came in was a lot better. But so I'd give a shout out to Reaper. Mialbi was a great leader at yeah. the back. Paul Elliott was a bit before my time, although my dad loves him. And yeah. I actually like Big Julian. I think Julian at the moment's getting a lot of stick that he doesn't deserve. But yeah, Van Dijk and Bobo for me.
And one more comment about Baldy. I remember Baldy used to give me a reason to watch the African Nations Cup, which I had no interest in. And then you'd watch, I think it was Equatorial Guinea. Is that where he was from? It was one of the Guineas. It was basically, their team was just 11 Bobo Baldys. some of them literally were other Bobo Baldys and stuff. But,
they were the exact there. Opposite of Scotland.
yeah. Right. So who's completing your back four? Right back.
I'm going to go with Didier Agat. It has right. to be Agat. You know, I think his best position was wing back. But when the back three for Martineau kind of started to struggle a little bit against Rangers, when Alex McLeish basically figured it out and went 4-3-3 and played Lovenkrantz directly up against Mialbi in that kind of right of the back three position, O'Neill altered it, went back four and put Agat to right back, and you never heard of Lovenkrantz again after that. You know, yeah. Agat was just, I thought he was... His pace, first of all, was the fastest I've ever seen. Even from opposition players, I don't ever remember seeing someone who I would have thought was as fast as Agat in the flesh. He was devastatingly quick. And that was what gave him a lot of his defensive quality, that when he came up against guys like Ronaldinho and even Damien Duff when he played Blackburn in the Seville run, his pace was just so frightening that those guys, even though they maybe had a trick to get past him, he would just catch them up after a couple of strides, and they knew they couldn't get away from him. But then going forward as well, when you think of the contribution he made in some of the huge European games, Stuttgart away is the one that stands out yeah. for me, as well as Ajax. I mean, the Ajax away game, he was playing wing back in that game, and shout out to Bobby Petter as well, who, if you ever watch that game back, it's probably the best performance I can remember for two wide players for Celtic, like both at the same time, yeah. just having amazing games. But over in Stuttgart as well, his pace was scary getting down that line and getting us a couple of crucial early goals.
That was such a strange game, Stuttgart, because we racked up, what, 3-0 lead away?
I think it was 2 over there.
And right, then, so we were 3-1 up, and then we went, what, so 4, or yeah, we went 5-1 up.
Yep, 5-1, yep.
And then contrived to throw that away in the second half, which was an extremely stressful affair.
But
yeah, Agat's contribution in that first half, which, you know, basically signs, seals, delivers the tie, he was outstanding.
Yeah, and it was just searing pace. Like the game over on Ajax, it was a fairly young Ajax team, but they had some serious players in that team that ended up going on to be big players. Christian Kivu was playing left back for him. He ended up going to Roma and having a good career in Serie A. And I think Mido was the other guy who was kind of playing left midfield. That's what he was up against as the wing back, you know, and he absolutely tore them. Like they just couldn't deal with him. His fitness levels, you know, getting up and down the wing defensively and offensively, the delivery into the box for Sutton. I know a lot of people slag his crossing ability, and his crossing ability could be a little bit hit and miss, but you could name quite a lot of crosses that came big goals that came from Didier Agat crosses, including Larsson, obviously, over in Seville.
And even if you watch highlights against the Huns, you know, a lot of John Hartson's and Sutton's and Larsson's goals, Ibrox and stuff involved a gap bombing down the right, you know, cutbacks and stuff. Yeah.
And against Rangers, he was also up against Arthur Newman, who was one of their very strongest players. You know, Newman was really good. But he basically, they almost nullified each other a little bit to an extent, I would say. But Agat, I think, got the better of it. Because, like you just said, there's I can remember more instances of Agat putting crosses in for Celtic to score in those games than Arthur Newman doing it. And he also ended up eventually handling Lovenkrantz and Newman, and sometimes Neil McCann, down that wing. And you know, none of them could get anything out of him.
Yeah, he was an excellent Celtic player. I wonder, just thinking back to the whitewash season, I wonder how many players played or, you know, started all five of those games. I'm sure Bobo probably did. Mm-hmm. Probably Agat probably did. You know, so if you were sort of measure your great Celts as, you know, contributing to that wonderful achievement, you know, there'd be a lot of good players in there.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Okay, so let's get away from our excellent defence and get into the more interesting midfield. You've got a three.
So I've got a three, and I need an anchor man in there. And Lennon and Lambert were great anchor men for Celtic, but I'm going to go with Wanyama. Has to be Wanyama. The presence that he had in the centre of the park. The Barcelona game was the one that obviously made Europe sit up and notice him. But he just had a massive presence, defending the back four, protecting the back four. He was physical. He could play a bit. He wasn't, you know, overly technical, but he was safe on the ball. He knew how to play it around. He was good for a goal at set pieces, and he could bang one from outside the box as well. And he obviously went on and he's had a great career in England, and I would quite like him back now from Montreal if we could. But Wanyama for me was just, he just had a little bit more athleticism than some of the other guys that I could have chose. Lambert was obviously brilliant, won the Champions League. Just a little bit lightweight for me sometimes going to Ibrox. I remember him a few times getting stretchered off at Ibrox, maybe sometimes through no fault of his own when George Albert stuck his knee through his face. Yeah. But Wanyama for me just gave you that extra strength and physicality that just separated. And he also just had quality as well that separated him from the rest.
I think this is the position I think most about, because I loved Lambert. You know, I absolutely loved Paul Lambert. But ultimately, if I had to, you know, if a Celtic Lifetime 11 was to play, I don't know, a team from Mars tomorrow, and I had to pick Celtic players, I think I'd pick, it'd be between Lennon and Wanyama, because Lennon was hard. Lennon was, like, and I'm a guy that, you know, Lennon's biggest critic as a coach, but he was such a good central defensive midfielder.
Yeah.
He was hard as nails. And I would say Wanyama was as hard as Lennon, plus could bang one in for 25 yards relatively regularly.
Yeah.
I would lean towards Wanyama probably myself.
I agree with what you said. The two of them were similar in that were both hard. Wanyama was just more physically gifted than Lennon, probably. He was a bit faster. He was probably a bit more athletic and stronger than Lennon. But the way I kind of think about it, like you're saying, a team from Mars, I always kind of think if we were going to Ibrox tomorrow and you're going in against a good, strong Rangers team, who am I going to choose to win that game?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where guys like Baldy, Wanyama, Van Dijk, Tierney, these sort of guys, I would, you know, feel comfortable with him, even though some of the other guys that we've mentioned, Lambert and Lennon and that, great players, but I would have to go with Wanyama.
I think just to pick out a single moment that was worth talking about, I remember that season where we'd, you know, fallen way behind and then turned the season round. The season largely turns when Wanyama goes into the team. You know, I think he maybe came on at half-time away at Kilmarnock when we were 3-0 down. And then from then on, you know, we are unstoppable.
Yep.
But that builds up to that moment. I think it was in December where we're struggling to break down Hearts. It's 0-0. And Wanyama just nuts one from, you know, 25 yards late on, nearly takes the net off, you know, just with no run-up. You know, zero step. Just it falls to his feet and his right foot just goes bang like a video game. And he nearly burst the net. He was such a good Celtic player.
No, he was fantastic. And I always remember Gary Neville talking about him after the Barcelona game. I think it was Redknapp, Neville and John Collins were on the panel that night. And Neville was raving about him. Like, he was actually sitting in the chair saying, Celtic are, you know, with all due respect, Celtic are really going to struggle to hold on to this guy because he was just colossal. And he was up against Xavi and Iniesta that night. Yeah. And although he didn't take them on kind of head-to-head and outplayed them, obviously, but he was able to you know, hold out against them. And what a presence he was that night, you know, fantastic.
Yeah, loved VW. I tried to construct the nickname The Beetle, you know, Volkswagen VW. It never caught on. I think it's too late. It's not gonna.
If it comes back, we can try it.
Yeah, The Beetle, we'll try it. It's out there. Right. Okay, so who are the two playing, I guess, his left or right or just in front of him?
Yeah, so my two number eights, and this goes back to my, you know, when I first started watching Celtic, he was kind of my hero. I'll start for the left here, John Collins. Collins, for me, was just such a classy player. And him and McStay really carried Celtic through that kind of early 90s to mid-90s period. And I just wish the team that I've got here, my 11, if I could have seen Collins playing with a Wanyama behind him and the guys that I'm going to put in front of him, you know, compared to what he actually had to work with back in the day, it would have just made him even better than the player that he was. At international level, he was always a standout for Scotland. He was, as he got a little bit older when he first came to Celtic, he wasn't a huge goal threat, but as time went on, he just added more and more goals. He was two-footed. He was a leader on the pitch. His set pieces were deadly. I thought Collins was a real, real good player. And he's probably slightly maybe underrated or looked down upon because he left on a Bosman, which, you know, is, you know, you can argue if that's fair or not. But when he left and he went to Monaco, his class was still there, and he was just a brilliant, brilliant player.
Yeah, went and won a French title, and just, yes, yeah, slotted in next to Emmanuel Petit and Thierry Henry, etc.
Yep.
Just a fine footballer. I think he's one of the few that left on a Bosman, but with my full blessing. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? If you've done your time, you know, you don't owe Celtic anything at that point. You know, like when Simon Donnelly and Phil O'Donnell left, it pissed me off because, mm-hmm. you know, they hadn't given us, you know, four 50 games a season, seasons in a row. You know, Collins was always there, always contributing, always sticking it to the Huns. Collins couldn't have done any more for Celtic.
No, and the thing is, it's hard for us to imagine. See, when you're a Celtic fan, it's hard to imagine walking away because it's all you ever dream of is playing for Celtic. And I put myself in that situation. I think, God, if it was me, I don't know if I'd be able to walk away from Celtic.
Yeah.
But the guy was, I think he was 28 years old at that point. This was the last chance for him to make sort of, you know, bigger money than what he was already on at Celtic. And back then, footballers weren't getting the crazy money that they get now. He was probably looking at it a little bit for that. And he was also looking at the chance to go to Monaco, which was, you know, a beautiful place in the world and also a great team and a chance to maybe go on and win big trophies. I think they went to the semi-final of the Champions League and knocked out Man United in the quarter-final. He was directly up against Beckham at that point, and then I'm pretty sure I remember watching it and thinking that he outplayed him. And yeah, it's hard to hold that against him. I was heartbroken when he left, I have to admit. When I was growing up, he was the guy who I had the pictures on the wall. You know, they were pinned on the door, pinned on the wall. And there's only been one or two other players that when they left, I was as upset as I was when Collins left because he was brilliant. And we needed him at that point, which was the pity, you know, but there you go.
I vividly remember going to a park with my pal Kev, you know, early 90s. I must have been 11, 12, 13, and just hitting free, you know, just two of us, a goal and a ball sort of thing.
Yeah.
And me just trying, you know, just hitting free kicks with my left foot, and my mate just being like, you're not left-footed. you can't do this. You're rubbish at this. And me just being like, no, John Collins does it with his left. I'm doing it with my left. And, you know, I'll credit where it's due. I ended up with a relatively good weaker foot in my football career. Maybe it was all down to John Collins or aspiring to be John Collins.
Well, I was left-footed, and I tried to hit free kicks like John Collins, and I couldn't do it. So I wouldn't worry about it too much. But he was, he was one of the first guys that I remember being. He wasn't as two-footed as other players that we might mention later, but he was. He had a good right foot on him as well. You know, he could cut in on his right foot and take a strike and play a pass. And he was he loved a goal against Rangers as well. He was he was big game player. You know, see when it came to Ibrox or when Rangers were more so at Ibrox, probably Collins really seemed to revel going to Ibrox's free kicks. I don't know if you remember the pass that he played to Paul Byrne when Paul Byrne scored the volley. stunning pass, you know, like real quality vision. And I always think it's when you hear about some of the other podcasts these days, when Collins is talking about his experience at Hibs and the players, including Scott Brown, coming through there that didn't like his methods about, you know, his fitness regime and his double training sessions and stuff. And I heard Stephen Fletcher talking about it recently, and it's really, it's easy for me to see sitting here, obviously, but it makes you think that what were those players at Hibs thinking? You've got a guy like John Collins, who was a true international class player, Scottish guy, and he's telling you, look, I went to Monaco, here's how the top guys done it, here's what they ate, here's how they trained, here's how you need to live. And they all revolted and wanted him out.
Yeah, his coaching career, I don't know why he... To put his contemporaries, like Germany gave Klinsmann the job, you know, Van Basten got the Dutch job, you know, guys that were good international stars in their country and just went straight into their national team gigs, basically. Why Scotland never just handed the keys to the motor to John Collins, I'll never understand. Because we've just had shit managers for, you know, years and years and years and achieved absolutely nothing.
Yeah,
I don't know why, if not, you know, obviously Celtic have done well, but why has he not been the Scotland manager? I've absolutely no idea.
Or at least I think the role he was tailor-made for was that technical director role. Now, how much influence and say that role actually gives you, I'm not sure. But when you hear Collins talking about the grassroots of the game and how youngsters should be training and all that stuff, he just seems... I don't know if he's a great man manager. Maybe that's where it lets him down, you know. But in terms of his views of the game, and when you hear him talking about how he developed technically and things, he just seems... And then you compare that to the way that you hear some other managers, like guys who are actually got jobs talking in Scotland, and you hear the way it's dinosaur sort of talk. It makes you think, you know, how have Scotland had a guy like John Collins, great player, and they just don't seem to be making any use of him. But there you go.
Maybe someone will listen to this podcast. There'll be a giant U-turn, and we'll solve this problem. Right, who is completing this midfield?
So my other number eight has to be Paul McStay. Even though, so I was born in 1982, and my kind of memories, really watching Celtic only started probably kick in from maybe like 93, I would say maybe 92 at the earliest, 93. But so I never seen McStay in his prime, never seen him in the centenary season. But even then, he just had that quality around him that he was able to almost, between him and Collins, they were able to dominate a midfield. You know, like the amount of teams that we went to Ibrox in the 90s and Celtic would dominate the game but end up losing. But the domination of the game and the kind of hold of midfield was basically down to McStay and Collins. Yeah. And if they had a Van Dijk or a Baldy or a Reaper behind them, and they had a Wanyama backing them up, and they had other guys in front of them helping them put the ball in the net, they would have been unbelievable. And McStay... his passing is when you think of the pass that he gave to Chris Morris for McAvaney's goal in the centenary season, sums him up really. And again, another guy that when he played for Scotland was a real international class midfielder.
Definitely. I think a moment that comes to mind is the game you mentioned earlier, the Borussia Dortmund game, which we actually lost. But I remember, I think McStay must have been an injury doubt, you know, going into that game. But I remember being, it was the only game I was ever in the old Rangers end, next to the Dortmund fans. And I was, you know, just basically a little boy, you know. But I remember when the whispers went out that McStay had, I think, made the team. There was this sort of wave of belief, you know, like, and obviously we'd beat Cologne. We'd come back from a 2-0 deficit against Cologne. We were playing Dortmund with a smaller deficit. But when it was read out that McStay was playing, it was like this wave of, oh, we're going to do it. You know, he brought that to it. He was like, you know, Achilles walking out on a battlefield. You know, it was just like, all right, we're going to do it. I mean, ultimately, we didn't do it. But my point is that it was the hope, you know, the belief that he gave us, that he was just an absolute, you know, soldier that was going to do everything he could.
No, totally. And he was so crucial at that team as well that, like you're saying, if he wasn't there, you think it would have been a gaping hole in that midfield. You know, I don't know who they would have been putting in, Mike Galloway or Peter Grant or Brian O'Neill or whoever, but McStay and Collins were just carried Celtic at that point. And, you know, when you think back to the 90s and we were finishing fourth and fifth in the league, you imagine how bad it would be without those two guys. It would have been a lot worse.
much worse. So, yeah, guys that would definitely... be contenders in my own lifetime of living. Wanyama, McStay, Collins. And now we get to the fun part. The last, the big two, because let's be honest, I'm going to assume Henrik's there.
Well, you know what they say about assuming.
All right, okay. right, so who's playing behind your front two?
So there's only one answer to this question, and as good as Nakamura was, he wasn't Lubo Maravchik. Lubo Maravchik was the best natural football player I've ever seen at Celtic. You know, I would, the two guys, I mean, Nakamura and Di Canio would be pretty close in those roles, even though Di Canio outside of football is not a great guy. But Lubo was just fantastic. The most two-footed player I've ever seen in football, not even just with my own eyes or not even just at Celtic, but just in football. I honestly have no idea what his best foot was, and you hear people talking about it all the time, but he used to hit corners with both feet. He used to, you know, hit direct free kick with both feet. He would shoot with both. He would volley with both. Unbelievable. And he just had that intelligence as well to open up a defence, you know.
And his header against Kilmarnock in a League Cup semi-final was one of the best headers you'll ever see. He scored a header from like the edge of the box.
Yep.
Absolutely ridiculous. Like,
and the one that he scored against,
don't score those goals.
Yeah, and the one that he scored against Rangers in the 5-1 game as well, just a brilliant header. When you see it from behind the goal, it just kind of drills right into that bottom corner. His technique was flawless. Controlled the ball with his arse cheek one time, which was just one of the greatest things you'll ever see. And he was, and in some of the games that he played in, like Rangers games, I thought the 6-2 game, he never scored in the 6-2 game, but he had a hand in all three of the first three goals. You know, he played Bobby Petter down the line, which led to Rixon basically getting a concussion when Petter tripped over him. And then the corner came in for Maravchik and Sutton sticks it away. The second goal, it was his, again, awesome delivery for a corner right onto Petrov's head. And then the third goal turns Barry Ferguson inside out before putting it on a plate for Lambert. He just, especially in the Martin O'Neill team, like when Celtic played a 3-5-2, and you had, you know, usually maybe Lennon and Lambert playing behind him or Petrov for one of those two. Maravchik was just the link between that midfield to that attack. The other players, even Petrov for me, couldn't quite do it. You know, Maravchik just had that brain to give you that bit of spark, give you that bit of creativity that when he retired, we never... I don't think we ever quite replaced that, and that was a pity.
I remember my season ticket around that era was the, you know, where the Green Brigade are now, you know, the standing section, that's where we sat.
Right.
And so it sat right behind, you know, a million Lubo corners on his right foot. Mm-hmm. And he really, unlike any other guy that I ever saw hit a corner, you know, he really gunned them. You know, they had a weird trajectory, you know, they went high, but you knew they were coming down at pace, you know. Some people complain about, you know, a high corner, but it's always seemed to land on someone, you know, going like an absolute rocket, and you know, a Petrov or a Reaper or a Larson would just, you know, bullet it in.
And that's like you're saying, the pace he put them in, it made it so hard to defend. And the crazy thing was he'd done it with both feet. Remember the corner that he scored direct was with his left foot, you know. And it's the technique that he had for delivering the ball into the box, and his performances in Europe, when you think one of the things I always look back on with O'Neill, which surprises me, Martin O'Neill, great manager, obviously, and turned Celtic around. But the season we were in the Champions League with Juventus and Porto and Rosenborg, he only started Maravchik in one of those games, and it was the final game at home at Juventus. And he tore Juventus to shreds in that game for 60 minutes. And he was like 35 at the time, maybe even 36. And it always amazed me that O'Neill kind of wanted to go more physical, and he would leave him out for Petrov. He would play Petrov in that role for his legs and all the rest of it. But to have a guy like Maravchik there, and then when we eventually did play him, and then when we went out of the Champions League that year, I don't know if you remember, we played Valencia in the UEFA Cup when we went out in penalties. And he was brilliant in that game as well at Parkhead. Yeah. He put Larson through on goal a couple of times, and he should have scored one himself where he nutmegged a guy and cracked it over the bar. But he was just so dangerous, and he was a true, pure footballer, two-footed, could score and everything. He was.
I think one of the real sickeners is the end of that season where he's an unused sub in a cup final that we lose. And you're just like, for fuck's sake. Do you know what I mean? Just.
I know. And I was always gutted that he did actually retire, because he was getting old, but his performances didn't really justify. He didn't seem to be. It wasn't like Reaper, yeah, where he was battling a toe injury or something, yeah, mental. He just decided his time was up. And then the next season was the Seville season. And you just think, having a guy even, you know, for 20 minutes off the bench at the end of,
yeah,
20 minutes for the end over in Seville or whatever game it was, what a difference having a guy like that coming off the bench. But yeah.
Yeah, an absolute genius. We've had some of them.
Nakamura and Di Canio were pretty close. Di Canio, as much as a horrible guy, seems to be genius on the football part. He was one of the other ones that when he left, along with Collins, I was gutted at that point.
Yeah, I'll save all my Di Canio stuff for the day someone legitimately picks him. I don't think that day will ever come, but I've got a lot of Di Canio chat, and it's not anti-Di Canio. It's very pro. Right, so who is your first striker playing in front of Lubo?
You preempted it earlier, but I'm going to say something here, right? So I'm not going to choose Larsson in this setup.
All right, okay.
And there's a reason why I'm not going to do it. It's not because I'm mental. It's because I think everyone that's been on your podcast so far has chosen. You must be sick of talking about him, right? Okay. And he had a stinker in the 2002 Scottish Cup final against Rangers, so I hold that against him. You know, I would pick him. However, I'm going to not pick him. I'm going to go with Edouard, actually. I think Edouard at the minute is... it was very close between him and Moussa Dembele. I thought the two of them are head and shoulders the best we've had since Larsson. And you would have to go back to, you know, the George Cadets or the Vidukas or someone like that to come close. You know, for me, Edouard at the minute is... We've just got to enjoy him as long as he's there. He's got so much quality. He's striking in hearts, and we're talking about the other night. He can play as a really good nine. He can play as probably even a better 10, just dropping off into that space. So intelligent. His feet, when he gets the ball, it's funny watching him sometimes, because the ball, quite often when he's running through defenders, even the other night there against Reykjavik, he sometimes gets a little, you know, it kind of takes a wee bumble or a wee knock, but he always seems to get it back, and then he'll stick it away or something. But when he can face up a defender and run at them, he's brilliant. But he can also lead the line, and he's unselfish, and he's a big game player. You know, he scores in Europe, he scores against Rangers. Him and Dembele were very, very close. But I just think Edouard's got a little bit more intelligence to drop off into that number 10 position than what Dembele did.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. I made a prediction to my mates 12 months ago. It was, remember when the game where Christie scored the hat-trick? The opening game of the season last year.
Yeah, okay. Yep.
And in that game, Edouard went on some crazy run. You know, he beat like six guys and then, you know, smashed over the bar.
Yep.
And at that point, I said to my pals, Edouard's going to score one of these goals that is like YouTube, Twitter mad. You know, it's going to send the world crazy. You know, the way Zlatan did before he left Ajax. Zlatan scored a famous goal against NEC Breda where he beat 15 guys and rolled it in the middle of the goal. You know, it was just an incredible goal. And my prediction was, you know, Edouard's got one of them in him. Yep. It's just a matter of time. And then, obviously, the season got curtailed because of COVID and all that. But I think had he played, you know, Christmas to the summer, uninterrupted, playing the way he was, there was a viral goal there. And then the other night, it was against a pub team, but, you know, it was an amazing goal.
Yeah.
But I think he's got a really epochal wonder goal in him. Hopefully it's against the Rangers or someone, you know, where he just does something absolutely incredible. He's so unpredictable and his touch is amazing. I think it's there and I think it's coming.
And he's got that talisman quality that Larsson had. You know, seeing the team at the moment, like if Edouard's not in the team, you go, oh no. You know, where he makes the other guys around him seem better players. He can do pretty much everything. You know, he can lead the line, he can drop off. But he's just a big game player as well. When you think he's, you know, some of the goals in Europe, Copenhagen away from home, and then even the penalty that he took at home, that didn't turn out the way we wanted, obviously. But he's the talisman in that team at the moment. And Dembele came pretty close, because when you look at Dembele now at Lyon, he's a specimen physically. And you know, when he first came to Celtic, I thought his first season at Celtic he was at his best. He was a little bit leaner than what he was in his second couple of seasons. And he had just tremendous physicality. His pace and power was awesome. I don't think Edouard quite has the same pace and power as Dembele, but he makes up for it with a bit more probably intelligence and creativity as well.
You can see, I mean, I've definitely read somewhere that at sort of 14, 15, you know, his stock was higher than Mbappe's.
Right.
So you can imagine before youth football, you know, evolves into adult football and real physicality becomes the real thing. You can imagine a young Edouard, you know, coming off the streets of his Paris suburb, just being an absolute baller, you know, just absolutely taking the piss out of people.
No, and, totally.
For different reasons, their careers have gone in different paths at this point. But there's a raw genius in him that, you know, you can't learn that. You know, that's just a guy that's been born better than everyone else.
Yeah, and I think it'll be interesting whenever the unfortunate time comes that he does leave Celtic, and hopefully we get at least 40 million for him, because we shouldn't be taking less than that. But when the time eventually comes, it'll be interesting to see how he does, because, you know, when you hear Strachan talking about him, he kind of compares him a little bit to Bergkamp. I think he's got a little bit of Thierry Henry about him. He's not at the level of those guys yet.
Yeah.
Could he get there? Maybe. But he's definitely good enough. When you look at some of the guys that are playing for Man United at the moment, and even Arsenal, and even a Liverpool or something, you know, if you were to go and take Firmino out and put Edouard in, I think Liverpool would get on just fine with it, you know, and he's got a lot of quality. I hope he, when he does go, I hope he proves it really, really big, because it just, you know, keeps that precedent going that Van Dijk, Wanyama and Dembele and Tierney have all been setting.
And people our age, you know, we've been spoiled with strikers. I mean, we obviously, if someone's going to say, wait a minute, you know, from Chris Killen to God knows who else, spoiled. There was a good 8 years before that, you know, before the lean years, it was pretty damn good. So we have points of reference. And you're literally talking about a guy, Edouard, who's, you know, he's got the best of Aduka, some of Larsson, you know, a bit of Van Hooijdonk. You know, he's just brilliant. He really is as good as, potentially as good as all of these guys, and still so very young.
And he's a total all-rounder as well. Like some of the guys that you named there, there was maybe something that was just lacking in their game to take them to the absolute top. You know, maybe a bit of pace or a bit of quality in the air or something. But Edouard's got all of that. You know, Edouard, he's got pace. He can hold the ball. He's got intelligence. He can score 25, 30 goals a season. He can play in a couple. I think you could play him off the left in a front three as well. Yeah. He's just, you know, there's not any real weakness in his game, and he's still pretty young. You know, give him another couple of years, and if he does move on and he ends up getting coached by a Klopp or, you know, someone like that, you know, he could be absolutely terrific.
Yeah, he could really kick on. Right, brilliant. So, who's supporting him up front?
So when I was putting it together, I was thinking about, you know, the old Martin O'Neill, big man, little man style. And although Edouard's not really a little man, but I love a target man at Celtic, and I'm going to go with Van Hooijdonk.
Okay.
Yep, Van Hooijdonk for me was a lot of the things that we said about Edouard there, apart from pace is the only thing that stopped him from being, you know, like top quality. But you could say the same thing probably about Sutton, about Hartson, even about Viduka, who was pretty close to getting in here. But Van Hooijdonk, man, he was a big game player. He was one of those guys that when Celtic needed a goal quite often in a Rangers game, or in, you know, when you were trailing late or drawing late to Kilmarnock or Dundee United or something, he would pop up with that header, or he would get a goal out of something. And he had that Dutch swagger about him as well, that he just had a confidence. And he was massive. What was he, about 6'5" or something?
Yeah.
You know, his set-piece threat in the air was brilliant. His link-up play was great. I would have loved to have seen him play with Larsson, actually.
Yeah.
Remember the Stylian Petrov testimonial a few years back when all the legends came? And Van Hooijdonk and Larsson were on the pitch at one point, and even though they were both in their mid-40s, I was watching it thinking, God, this is... I'd have loved to have seen that in their prime. But Van Hooijdonk was superb. He was... scored a lot of big goals.
Yeah, scored some absolute brilliant goals. Off the top of my head, the header in the 3-3 game at Ibrox is one of the great Celtic headers. You know, Tosh McKinley's sprayed down the left, like literally on the corner flag when he reaches it, but gives it everything he's got just to hook the ball back into play, lands at the near post. And up until that point, Pierre had been pish in the air. You know, he'd barely scored a header, certainly none as grand and spectacular as this one. But it arrives on him at the near post, and he does the absolute definition of a glanced header, and it spins in slow motion into the far post, clips the post, spins into the goal, and you know, the looks in the faces of the Huns defence is just absolutely priceless. And off he goes into the, you know, the Celtic end at Ibrox, and just such a good goal. And then he never stopped. You know, he had a proper like 25, 30 goal season where he was just, you know, statistically just the best striker in the country.
Yeah.
And just a goal machine, you know, a goal every week basically.
Yeah. I agree totally on that goal, and how Tosh McKinley dug that cross out, when you watch it still, it's amazing. But great header, he leaves, I think it's Alan McLaren, and maybe Richard Goff just leaves him, you know, standing, and he gets up that height that he's got and puts it in. And even when he went to Nottingham Forest and he moved around a few places after that, you know, he's stuck in those, remember the two identical free kicks against Rangers for Feyenoord in the UEFA Cup. But that was another part of his game. Set pieces, he was... Behind Nakamura, he was pretty close to being, you know, the best set piece taker. I would have seen at Celtic. You know, there's a couple other guys you would put in there, maybe Collins and Ravchik and one or two others. But Van Hooijdonk had a great free kick on him.
It was a strange evolution because me and my brother used to be behind the Wayne Biggin stand. And that season, we'd be watching Van Hooijdonk would always make sure it hit some free kicks, you know, warming up.
Yep.
And you could see he didn't have it down. Do you know what I mean? He wasn't pulling rank over Collins at that point. Collins was still on free kicks.
Yep.
But Van Hooijdonk would always warm up. And you could see what he was trying to do. He had this big leggy run up. He was trying to get it up and down, but it wasn't working yet.
Yep.
And then he clearly just figured it out. And it is, you know, practice makes perfect. And eventually when he started doing it, he never stopped. You know, that last half season he played, he scored a great goal against Aberdeen on the first day of the season, you know, one of the great Celtic free kicks on the right, but sweeping down into the far left side of the goal, just unstoppable.
Yep.
Definitely scored at least three more, you know, as the season progressed, and then he was gone before long.
Yeah.
But then he went down to Notts Forest and Feyenoord and beyond, and was just like literally one of the great free kick hitters on the planet, you know, with up there with Janinho and Beckham, you know, a genuine like A-list free kick taker.
Yep. No, I agree. And the other thing that for me, I always just felt like, if we're going to Ibrox tomorrow, I always felt he gave Rangers a lot of trouble. You know, I always felt like Andy Tom, I loved Andy Tom, but he never, apart from that one rocket that he stuck in Ibrox, I don't remember him doing much against Rangers. And I just don't know if it was the physicality of those games that he didn't like. But Van Hooijdonk gave them trouble, and their centre-halves tried to rough him up, but it never really put him off. And he scored quite a few big goals against them. And also, you know, the first trophy that I ever seen Celtic lift, the Scottish Cup, in 95.
Yeah,
and Van Hooijdonk stuck that header in. That was, you know, it was such a huge moment that, you know, because that game, although we should have won it more convincingly, we only won it 1-0. And if we'd have lost that one after losing the Raith Rovers Cup final, which I was also at that same season, Jesus, that would have possibly buried, you know, everyone almost, because we were so desperate for anything. The resembling success at that point. And if we'd have lost to Airdrie in that cup final, man, I don't know where we would have went at that point. But Van Hooijdonk stuck that one in, and it was, I'm struggling to remember the, because we never had many great runs in Europe at that point, but even against a couple of teams like Innsbruck Tyrol maybe and Kasichi and things, I'm sure he stuck in a goal here or there. But it was I always felt like when you needed a goal, you know, you're going into the 90th minute and we're drawing away to Dundee United or Kilmarnock or something. Yeah. Van Hooijdonk was one of the guys, similar to Larson or similar even to like Edouard now, that talisman a little bit, that he was your go-to guy.
So many games that on target season, on target was the video of the review video that I think a lot of people remember as the on target season. Like games that weren't on TV, so it's literally just, you know, sitting around a radio listening.
Yep.
And so many of them are. And Van Hooijdonk scores in the 90th minute. You know, like, he did it so often when we needed it.
Yep.
And also, I think he was a young guy. You know, he wasn't peak anywhere near it. He was, like, early 20s when he comes.
Yep.
So he probably was about, I don't know, at the latest 25 when he left.
Yeah.
So,
and he was also
Edouard, you know, a guy that was improving while he was there.
And he was also one of the very first foreigners really coming into Celtic. You know, that kind of when all of a sudden... English football as well started bringing in more foreigners. Van Hooijdonk was pretty much the first. Rudy Vatta was there, I suppose, already. Yeah. But you know, like
Van Hooijdonk was on the podcast.
He's not in the team though. But Van Hooijdonk was, you know, before Tom, before Cadet and Decanio, and that he was the first one to arrive. And I remember going to see him at Hampden. I had a season ticket behind the goal in Hampden that year. Yeah. And when we seen him coming out, you're like, my God, he's massive. And then he scored an absolute peach on his debut. And he just, you know, for that moment, you knew that we had something good. Pity the way it ended for him, you know, it was his fault, and that'll be held against him. And you kind of really, some of the comments he made, you know, about the homeless thing and that, you kind of, obviously, that was just idiocy. But as a player, he was a big player. And when I was looking at the alternatives, I liked Viduka. I thought he played Amoruso very well. I thought Sutton was obviously a great partner to Larson. Hartson was brilliant. You know, was a guy that I thought was massively underrated. Scored in 6 away Champions League games on the trot, right through qualifiers to the group stage. You know, there's not a lot of guys that could have or have done that. So I liked Sammy, but Van Hooijdonk was just quality, I thought.
Yeah, fine Celtic player. A time when we needed a bit of magic. Right, that is a very strong team. Probably the closest in the series to my own thinking. There's nobody I'm really disagreeing with here. Yeah, very, very strong team in my view. But we always end the podcast with the one that got away. So who's your option?
There's two. I'll give you one, right? But the two that one of them we actually had for a while, and it was Craig Bellamy. When he was here on loan, he was it was electric. He was exactly what that team needed. Like post Larson and after Janinho and Henri Camara not working out, when he came in January, he really just lit up that team. And because that team at that point had lost a lot of legs as well. There was aging guys in there, the Suttons, the Hartsons. Petrov was the only guy who could really get about anymore. Alan Thompson, Lennon. It was a team that was slowing down quite rapidly. And when Bellamy came in, he was rapid, fast. He was scoring big goals. He had that bit of fire in his belly that he loved the big games. And you felt like he got the club. Yeah. And I felt like I was, at the end of that season, there was a lot of talk of Celtic going to try and get him permanently. And I was really hoping that we would. And Strachan obviously had links with him, but he just seemed to be too expensive at the end up. And he went on to, when he was at Man City especially, he was arguably English player of the year 1 year when he was down there. I think he finished third in the voting or something, but he was fantastic. But having said all that, the guy that I'm going to throw in is Hakan Yakin. Don't know if you remember Hakan Yakin.
Basel's
number 10. And it goes back a little bit to what I was saying about when Mravchik retired. I felt like when he retired, Petrov could play in that role, in that kind of almost a number 10 box-to-box role, but he wasn't the same type of player as Mravchik, and Hakan Yakin was. And when he played us with Basel and they knocked us out, he was quality. Like, he played a stunning pass in the away leg over there. He put them, I think it was the goal that put them 2-0, maybe it was their first goal, he put them 1-0 up over there, but he absolutely just threaded it through our defence. For Switzerland, he was good. And I remember we got linked to him a few times. And he just seemed to me like the exact sort of guy that we needed to replace Mravchik. A kind of maverick number 10. He could score goals, great left foot. He had a wee bit of fire about him as well. And I was actually a little bit surprised that he didn't go on to do more in his career than what he eventually did. Because I think he moved to Germany and was kind of okay, but nothing special over there. But I think Celtic would have been a good fit for that guy as well. And O'Neill would have probably got the best out of him. But I'd like to know why we didn't get him, because I'm pretty sure we were in for him. And I don't know if it was just the money or what happened, but yeah, he would have been, I'd have loved to have seen that guy linking up in behind Larson and Sutton and in front of, you know, Lennon and Petrov.
Yeah, he was a proper talent, you know, just a classic number 10, would have scored free kicks, would have, you know, picked locks, would have been a fine Celtic player. There should always be room for a player like that in a Celtic team, I reckon.
Yeah.
You know, Mravchik or Nakamura or whatever. And he certainly would have come in handy in that post-Mravchik era.
Yeah, I think when you think of guys that we've mentioned so far, like you're saying, Mravchik, Nakamura, a Decanio, Andy Tom, even, you know, that kind of number 10 that just links the play, goes between the lines,
yeah.
got a goal and all the rest of it. And he would have been a guy like that for me. I thought he would have been really good in that team. And the team would have suited him as well, because you had all the physical power in that team that would have just allowed him to slot in and be the footballer right in that hole. And he was one that I was pretty disappointed we didn't get. But there's been a few over the years. Bellamy, the other one for me, I was desperate to get him permanently, but there you go.
There you go. Right. Excellent. Okay. Thanks, Tony, for doing the podcast. I hope you enjoyed being involved.
Yeah. Thank you, Anthony. No, it was a good experience. Podcast debut. So, brilliant.
Excellent. Okay. Thanks for listening. Bye.
This podcast was brought to you by Supersound.
Supersound.